Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, I'm David Ross, and welcome to episode 4 of The Sun's new podcast, Israel's War on Terror. Israel's response to Hamas's October 7th terror massacre is now well into its second phase, with the IDF confirming it's expanded its operations. And whilst it might not yet be a full ground offensive, Israeli soldiers and tanks are now on the ground in Gaza, engaging with Hamas and trying to destroy its terrorist infrastructure. With more than 200 hostages still being held captive, reliable intelligence has never been more vital. Former Israeli intelligence officer and senior official on Arab affairs, Avi Melamed, is one of the world's most qualified authorities on the subject. And despite the intelligence failings that led to October 7th, he says Hamas's tactic of taking hostages might not be the advantage the terror group thinks it is. Avi, firstly, give me your impression of what exactly happened in terms of a security failure to allow the horrific terror atrocities of October 7th.
Well, look, I would say that at this point, there are more questions than answers. It's very clear that it was a colossal failure of both the Israeli intelligence as well as the operational system. I don't know to say that I know the ins and outs. Obviously, there are many parameters that has to be very thoroughly investigated. This is something that I'm sure that will be done down the road. But the fact is that that has been a major failure of the Israeli military and intelligence establishment. And I hope and believe that down the road, we will have much more knowledge and understanding of the whole process, the whole chain of failures that basically resulted in this kind of like domino effect failure.
How difficult is it to get reliable information on the ground in somewhere like Gaza?
Well, you know, in our world, it's always difficult to get reliable information. You have always to check the information. You have to find out with other sources. You have to cross the information with other, puzzles or pieces of the puzzle. But in the end of the day, there is a lot of ways and means to basically be able to gather some sort of like a puzzle that reflects to a large extent accurately the reality.
And how surprised are you that Hamas was able to pull off this attack without there being major leaks during the planning process?
This is one of the major achievements that Hamas can mark. I mean, you know, to plan something like that and to keep it totally in secrecy, like, you know, nothing is leaking. This is definitely something that Hamas can mark. Look, we did obviously had knowledge that Hamas has an intention to storm and to take communities or to obviously try to capture hostages. So the scenario was there in the system. It wasn't a scenario that was totally unthinkable of. It was something that was definitely in the mind of the Israeli intelligence and operational apparatus. But I think that talking particularly specifically about October 7th, I think that maybe there was an inability to understand the scale of what is coming. It's quite clear, I think, at this point that we could say that we had information coming in that we evaluate as a reliable one very shortly before the attack. But I think that the information provided was not alluding to something at the scale of what we saw at October 7th. I think that based upon what I understand, that piece of information was there, but it was basically something that was alluding to some kind of like a scenario that was more of like imprinted in a way in the minds of Israeli intelligence and security apparatus as something that can be taken place and something that is probably could take place. but nothing like the scale of what we saw on October 7th.
And when you reflect back on your career in the intelligence service, is a reality like Israel has experienced in the last few weeks, would that have been something that you would have considered to be possible?
Well, you know, I left my positions, and this was many years ago. But, you know, ironically speaking, you know, when I was back in my position, one of the organizations that I was starting to cover as part of my work was an organization that was called Islamic Jihad. It was back then, relatively speaking, on its early phase, so definitely went a long way since then. Look, the challenges of the intelligence work are always there, you know, and particularly in our specific department that is in charge of the department I was part of was in charge of like issuing in the end of the day what we call the red alert, meaning basically saying, okay, there is a terror plot and we think that we have enough of intelligence that actually justifies the issuing of what we call red alert. Issuing red alert has a lot of ramifications. It basically means that once such an alert is issued, many agencies are going to work immediately, no questions asked. You know what I'm saying? You know, the army, the police, emergency agencies, and others. So it was always a very difficult challenge to say, do you have enough of solid information that you could say, yes, this is a situation that calls for red alert, or do you don't have enough components of knowledge? You don't have the puzzle, you have some substantial parts of this picture that are still missing that you cannot provide this red alert. It always, except for some very few cases where it was very clear that we have it. Most of the time, it was always involved in with this dilemmas, whether to issue the red alert or not.
Now, the second phase of Israel's response to Hamas's terror attack is underway with forces in Gaza on the ground. How much of a tactical advantage does Hamas have in the fact that it has taken so many hostages?
Hamas have a couple of cards that he plays with in that context. First, as you accurately mentioned, the issue of the hostages, which is a very substantial issue. In that regard, I would say that from a policy perspective, it seems to me like, and I've been saying that since day one of this crisis, it seems to me like that the Israeli policy is to, you know, if I try to sum it up in a nutshell, it seems to me like the Israeli policy is like fighting this war as if there are no hostages and negotiating for the release of the hostages as if there is no war. And I think that when I see the developments on the ground, I think that my assessment that I made it in the very early phase of this whole crisis is quite accurate, because this is what we see, roughly speaking, on the ground. In the sense of the hostages, Hamas has a card that he plays, obviously, for his own interest. But it's the same time also something that provides that it's also a burden in a way for Hamas, because as long as he holds the hostages, the kids and the women and the you know, senior people, many of them are foreign nationalists. You know, the international community is shocked by that, because, and rightly so, the international community says to Hamas, This is totally and utterly unacceptable. You cannot kidnap babies and kids and women and use them as a human shield or as a bargaining chip. You have to release them immediately or bear the consequences. And he's bearing the consequences, because as long as he's refusing to release those people and as long as he wants to try to use them both as a human shield and also as an insurance policy, the meaning of that practically on the ground is that he's going to sustain more and more massive losses, and he's going to lose more and more assets on the ground because Israel is striking, and it's striking hard. So this is one card that Hamas has. In fact, when I look at all of the cards of Hamas, they have kind of like a, you know, schism in a way. You know, it's on the one hand, they provide Hamas with a tactical advantage, but at the other hand, they're also kind of like, in a way, Achilles heel. So I gave the example of the hostages. Other thing is the tunnels. Obviously, Hamas' major or spine, military and tactical perspective or master plan is the tunnels, where Hamas is actually saying openly, he says, look, those tunnels are for us, for Hamas. They are not for the people of Gaza. They're not supposed to shelter the people of Gaza. They're supposed to shelter Hamas. And Hamas leaders are saying openly, they're saying, the people of Gaza is not our concern. Israel and the world should take care of the people of Gaza. We, Hamas, we need the tunnels to protect us, Hamas. And so you can understand that this is also something that presents Hamas with a challenge because, you know, people in the Arab world, for example, and people in Gaza are saying to Hamas, so you are throwing us under the bus while you are saving your skin in the tunnels. So this is something that creates an enormous challenge to Hamas in a way. So at the same time, you know, Hamas using the tunnels for its military purposes, and the tunnels on the one hand provides Hamas with a lot of tactical advantages. You know, they can move under the ground, they can use it as a place for regrouping, storing the weapons, all kinds of things. Places from where they could emerge, attack Israeli soldiers and run back to the tunnels. But at the same time, the tunnels have a lot of, you know, downsides. The tunnels could become, in a way, a burial site for Hamas terrorists. You know, we see this, you know, the aerial strikes on tunnels. Israel has developed this ability to basically use this weapon that infiltrate those tunnels and basically detonate them. And then there are other means that have been used and can be used. So for Hamas, again, the tunnels could become a double-edged sword, sort of speaking. So these are examples of the tactic cards that Hamas use. And obviously the issue of the humanity, of the using as the people of Gaza as a human shield, which is something that I believe that by now the international community, let alone the Arab world, they know that for a long period of time, understand Hamas is using the people of Gaza as a human shield. By the way, you know, it's interesting because for many years now, the Arab world is saying to Hamas, you are responsible for what happened in Gaza. It's your responsibility. You dragged Gaza Strip to havoc, to death and destruction, and you should be held accountable for that. And it's interesting, you know, that this very clear sentiment that, you know, is expressed in Arab world, you know, my work is to gather information from the Middle East, and most of the people are Arabs, and you know, I'm fluent in Arabic, I'm talking with people, I'm reading a lot of stuff, I'm hearing a lot of reports, and the information that flows in is just an enormous amount. And the picture is very clear. Many people in the Arab world for years are basically saying to Hamas, you have to be held accountable for the disaster of Gaza. And it's unfortunate that this very strong sentiment in the Arab world is not properly expressed in the discussion in the West, because there is a disturbing situation where some circles in the West actually exempt Hamas from accountability, while its own Arab brothers, including Palestinians, are holding him accountable.
But it seems that to the casual observer who tunes into the news every so often when the Middle East is at the center of the news agenda, they will see huge amounts of people taking part in protests against Israel around the world. And they will be of the perception that the world is with Hamas. Why does it manifest itself like that?
Well, this is a very significant question. Really, it has to do with a wider challenge. And now we are talking, actually, we are not talking now about Hamas, actually. What we are talking here is something, some very challenging process that evolved in the West, particularly, I would say, in academic, intellectual, cultural, and political circles in the West. And it has to do actually with what I see or view as the crisis of education. What I mean by that is to say that there has been a very harmful process within the educational system in the West, where outlook of a complex realities, like, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that outlook has been subdued to an emotionally based discussion, a discussion that is suffocated with narratives and sound bites and digestibly easy narratives and concepts that sounds wonderful, that sounds great, talking about occupation and aggression and imperialism and colonialism and freedom fighters. The only problem with that is that they have nothing to do with the reality. That distorted discussion, this, you know, infiltrated into the circles and resulted in something that, in my view, is nothing less than a toxic process. And the meaning of toxic process is that because cornerstones of education, which are relentless pursuit of information, critical thinking, contextualizing of information, understanding nuances, understanding languages that are so essential if you want to understand something that happens in a foreign arena, all those things have been pushed aside. And the outcome of that is a disastrous, harmful impact on educational level. And the sub outcome of that is that we see today this distorted phenomenon.
Obviously, anti-Semitism plays its part in that. And as Israel struggles to win on the ideas battlefield, it is conducting now a ground offensive in Gaza. As that progresses, how do you think that impacts the level of intelligence that the IDF has to assess? And does it make it easier or harder?
The bottom line, it makes it easier because, as I said from the beginning, once the IDF is on the ground there, one of the immediate meaning of that is there is a growing interaction with locals. You have a better access, roughly speaking, to potentially more human sources on the ground. You have a better ability to collect information using other means, and you have a better ability to have an enormous amount of information streaming in, and you could process that in real time while you are in motion, while you are on the ground. So in that sense, it's an advantage. It's an advantage for the Israeli Defense Forces because everything becomes closer, everything becomes shorter in terms of the process. So you could basically translate an incoming intelligence where it's evaluated as a reliable one. You could translate it into an operational product in a very short period of time.
And so as the chorus of countries and organizations continue to call for a ceasefire, would it be your view that that would be a mistake because the value in it would not be realized in terms of the release of hostages and the weakening of Hamas?
Yes, definitely. Look, this is a pivotal moment. This war is different from anything that we saw so far in the context of the Israeli-Gaza story. I think that the West really need to absorb and understand that this is the time where actually if people in the West really want to offer hope for Israelis and Palestinians, and many Israelis and Palestinians, they really need that hope. They really need this trajectory. If people in the West want to be helpful in that service, they need to internalize that the only way to do that is by depriving Hamas and Islamic Jihad the ability to continue and to dictate their radical agenda, which is actually the Iranian radical agenda. There is no other way. If Hamas and Islamic Jihad will be able to continue and dictate the radical agenda, you cannot talk about any hopeful trajectory of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You simply cannot. It wouldn't happen. If there is a way to deprive Hamas and Islamic Jihad to impact or to dictate their agenda, if there is a way to do it by sending them flowers and chocolates, I'll be more than happy to do that. I don't think it's going to work. So there is the option of, in the end of the day, forcefully make it happen. And the Israeli government says, we are going to end, eliminate Hamas military capacities and basically end Hamas rule over Gaza Strip. This is not only an interest of Israel. It's a Palestinian interest. It's a regional interest. It's an international interest.
Former Israeli intelligence officer and senior official on Arab affairs, Avi Melamed there. Well, intelligence inevitably had a role to play when Israeli jets struck Jabalia. The Hamas-run health ministry is claiming 50 people were killed at the refugee camp there. The IDF's Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner says the strike targeted a senior Hamas commander.
Jabalia refugee camp has effectively become a fortified position. Hamas has institutionalized, abused, and taken the people of Jabalia hostage. What we took out and what we struck yesterday was the staging ground, the position where the arch terrorist Ibrahim Biari was hiding out. He has been on the forefront of terrorism for the last two decades. And I'm sure if he was given the chance to conduct more butchery of our people, he wouldn't think twice. So he was a military target, a necessary military target. He was surrounded by his henchmen, and therefore he was a necessary target. Indeed, we know that he was involved in the planning and executing of the 7th of October attack in the vicinity of Jabalia and the forces that entered from the Jabalia area. And so, yeah, he was part of the operation that we are determined on destroying and dismantling Hamas, its capabilities, taking out its leaders. And this is what we did yesterday.
What does the IDF know to be the amount of people killed and the proportion of combatants versus civilians?
So in the aftermath of this, we're still looking at the differentiation between those numbers. We know that Biari was killed. We know several of his, some dozens of his accomplices and supporters were also killed. The magnitude of the strike is still unclear. What is very clear from the strike is that the building collapsed into the tunnel system that Hamas had built. And this is the reality of this battlefield that Hamas have established beneath ground. And so, yes, when we strike a senior Hamas battalion commander who has endless blood on his hands, he is the target, and those that are surrounding him are at risk. We have been now for 3 weeks encouraging people to evacuate the north of Gaza Strip, to evacuate places like Jabalia refugee camp. And we've seen that most of them have actually listened to us. Unfortunately, Hamas is trying to discourage many of the people not to go. And this is the challenge. This is what we face. We will continue to strike Hamas wherever they hide. We are determined on destroying and dismantling their capabilities and making sure that they never have the power to utilize in order to attack Israel ever again.
Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner from the Israel Defense Forces. That brings an end to episode 4 of Israel's War on Terror. Please let us know in the comments if you have any questions you'd like us to answer, and we'll do our best to take them on in later episodes. Thanks for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.